From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 314 of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. And we're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. All our lines are open. Any questions, comments you may have, be more than happy to discuss them with you and spend some time answering your questions. And emails are also very important. In fact, I wanted to start off with two emails that I received just recently. And actually, very important emails. One was someone who wasn't happy with a comment I made. The other was commenting on a recommendation for a treatment for restless leg syndrome. And the first one was from Cynthia. And I just wanted to read out the comment and then provide an answer to my reasoning. And this is, again, Cynthia wrote this saying, reference your interview of August the 6th on this subject was on the liberation treatment for MS. I cannot understand why you and many others in the medical community keep referring to this as a open quote, new close quote procedure. Opening stenosis in veins is a commonplace procedure. It is only MS patients that are being denied this procedure in this country. Who would be surprised that neurologists would be producing studies to counter this? I have met and or discussed the results of this treatment with six individuals who have had it. A woman from Toronto who had the treatment on July 14th had the sight restored in her right eye after losing it in 2007. I presume you and Dr. Mark Friedman will continue to call these stories open quote placebo effect, close quote. I think this comment's a fair comment. I'd like to point out that my reasoning has nothing to do with, first of all, I'm not a neurologist, and secondly, the implication that I'm calling this placebo effect is not entirely true. And I would like to point out that the procedure is one in which there isn't very much evidence to date that demonstrates that this works over the long term or that it even works in the short term. And my reasoning is such. There are centers around the world that are performing this procedure on the basis of one clinical study that wasn't rigorously conducted. If you review how it was done, the people who were in Dr. Zamboni's group of 65 were still taking their medications for MS. And so it's difficult to determine whether the procedure or the treatments, given that MS does relapse and remit at times, was responsible. And that can only be determined by doing more evaluation. The other issue is that if you have now hundreds of people being treated in other countries, what is the outcome of these procedures in a week, in a month, in a year, in 2 years? Are there MRIs done to see if the demyelination or the damage done to the nerves that is seen with MS, has that reversed itself? And again, how are they following up patients, right? People are going overseas, people are getting the procedure done, but are these same centers following up for complication rates? Are they following up to see how well they have done? What are their complication rates? Are they publishing this information? How are they gathering the data? How are they selecting patients? What is the restenosis rate? That is the rate at which the jugular veins will close up again. Afterwards, when you look at published data of this procedure of angioplasty of the jugular veins, the veins purported to be kinked and coiled, when you do do an angioplasty, restenosis or a return to where they were originally is quite commonplace. And so you have to have this procedure done many times. And each time you do that, remember, angioplasty of a jugular vein means you're inserting a guide wire into the vein, blowing up a balloon, stretching the walls of the vein. And although complication rates are relatively low, you still run the risk of rupture and of clots, clots that can end up in the lung causing pulmonary embolus. And if you have to repeat this procedure many times for someone, if it keeps blocking up again, eventually you're going to see more and more complication rates for that particular individual because of the number of times you're doing this procedure. The other issue is that what MS patient responds best? If the hypothesis is that this procedure works, who responds the best way, if indeed it does work? And what is the failure rate? How many people, and with all due respect to Cynthia, speaking to six people doesn't tell me what happened to all the other hundreds of people who may have had the procedure done. People who have things work are very happy, and they will tend to let people know. But because this is now becoming more of a politically charged issue as opposed to a science-based issue, wherein if there is a dissenting opinion or someone is asking for more evidence before recommending a treatment across the board to general populations of people who have MS, that doesn't make the someone who is asking for evidence the enemy. It's not someone who is trying to thwart the progression or understanding of how a disease process works or trying to deny someone treatment. It's rather making sure that what we're going to be doing and what you're going to be asking other physicians and radiologists and interventional radiologists to be doing is beneficial, will not cause harm to the patient, and the outcome of the procedure will produce long-term beneficial effects. That's all we're looking for, and you need to have evidence to do that. And so to have ad hoc implementation of procedures is fraught with dangers. If every study, one study that came up and showed a benefit, and because it becomes an emotionally charged issue, forces the implementation of a treatment for that on the basis of one study, that will result in complete anarchy with how we treat people without knowing who best to treat, what the indications are, what the outcomes are, what the complication rates are. All these issues have to go along with determining a treatment. And if people are reporting that they are receiving a benefit from the treatment, I would like to know what it is that made it better. And if indeed this treatment does do that, then all the centers that are doing these studies should be publishing their data in a way that it is that is acceptable. And you can't keep this kind of data down. You can't keep this away from people if it indeed works. And I don't think anybody is doing that. I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I don't believe that the neurologists are blocking anything. If they are producing studies, it's produced by the data that they are collecting and that they are publishing this data and having it open to everyone to criticize and review, which is exactly what should be done. And the same thing should be done for the procedures that are being done overseas and in other centers around the world. And that is all that my comment was. I'm not saying that I don't believe that the procedure works. I'm saying that if a claim is being made, then it is up to the person that is making the claim to show their data that covers all these questions in order for me to be able to accept that indeed this will be of benefit to patients. If you have any comments about that or other questions, and we do have people that are waiting on the line, I'd be more than happy to discuss them with you. I'm not offended in the least that someone is critical. I think it's a great idea for people to take me to task on things or ask for further clarification. And again, it's respectful. The letter writer was not being snarky. They were just simply asking for an explanation of why I make a statement a certain way. And I hope I've provided a good enough answer for that. And I welcome any return, rebuttal, or comment. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your calls in just a few minutes.
580 CFRA Sunday House Call. Your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255. Or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers, 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And I will get your calls in just a minute or so. There was one other email that I thought was important. This is from Margaret. And when I answered her email, I said I would mention this on the show today. I listen to your show as often as I can and enjoy it for the most part. However, I was very surprised to hear you mention Mirapex yesterday for the treatment of restless leg syndrome. While Mirapex might be an effective treatment, the side effects of this medication has ruined many lives. For example, compulsive gambling, delusions, and changes to libido. There was a documentary on W5 recently that was very informative. This was in, I believe, April or May of this year. Recently, that was very informative and frightening, and Mirapex should be taken off the market before more lives are ruined. This has happened to my partner, has left him bankrupt and ruined our loving relationship. Yours truly, Margaret. Well, Margaret raised a very good point, and my answer is as follows to her with regards to the use of this medication and any other. And I'll read verbatim what I wrote to her because it is short, but it does come to the point. You are correct that for some individuals, dopamine-like agents can cause the side effects you cite. This is also related to dosing and duration. The person they profiled on W5 had been treated for Parkinson's disease, which usually requires a greater dosing regimen, about three times the dose used for restless leg syndrome at the beginning. The maximum dose for Parkinson's treatment is 1.5 to 4.5 milligrams a day, or about 12 to 36 times the dose used for restless leg syndrome. Patients have to discuss the use of this medication with their physician, as I always point out when providing suggestions for these reasons. The patients that I have prescribed this med are on low doses, 0.125 milligrams at night, and have not experienced these side effects, and we remain vigilant for them. It is indeed regrettable that your partner suffered so. What dose were they taking? Were they taking it only before bedtime? Were they given increasing doses over time? Were they monitored by their physician? Thank you again for pointing this out. Your comments are important, and we'll bring this issue up on the air today. So the point being is that medications absolutely have side effects. And Margaret was absolutely right in writing this and mentioning her experience and her partner's experience with the medication. My point to this is that it is important also when looking at side effects, dosing, the amount that's being used, the indications it's being used for, and monitoring are extremely important for any medication because of these consequences. There was another very interesting and similar to what Margaret was saying, commentary on another radio show that's on NPR in the United States called Radiolab, which, by the way, is a science show that I recommend people listen to either through podcasts or even if they get NPR. Absolutely fantastic show called Radiolab. And they profiled a woman who had compulsive gambling, and she had spent her entire life savings, which amounted to over $300,000, on slot machines for a medication, not Mirapex, but a medication very similar to that, which was a dopamine-like agent that was originally used for her Parkinson's disease and helped her tremendously. But as the dose was increased and increased, her gambling, she would just start to gamble, and she didn't really understand why, other than the fact that the gambling and that the slot machines, when it would pay off, was a stimulus. It actually stimulated more dopamine when the bells would go off and the money would come down. It would stimulate that and give her what her brain was looking for. And so it would continually, literally train her to continue doing this gambling. But because of this medication, when the medication was taken away, the gambling stopped. So absolutely, Margaret, I'd like to thank you for writing that email and pointing that issue out. It's not just Mirapex that can do that, but any dopamine-like agent can do that, especially if it's being used to treat Parkinson's disease. So you have to take into account the dosing. And again, indeed, it is unfortunate that your partner had to experience those side effects. We are going to go to your calls right now and say good afternoon to Christine in Ottawa. Hello, Christine.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Dr. Dworkin, I have something in my right knee which has been diagnosed mm-hmm. as a Baker's cyst.
Right.
Otherwise known as a popliteal cyst.
Correct.
Where with water, I guess, it's going around the knee and it's kind of gathering in the back of my knee.
Correct.
And I've had this condition now for about almost 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to see my doctor. I've taken naproxen, which is an anti-inflammatory. And just in my last visit, he recommended to get this diclofenac, mm-hmm. diethylamine gel.
Right, to put on as more of an anti-inflammatory.
Yeah. And I've been taking Tylenol for arthritis. I've had the ultrasound, so that's how it was diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten myself a knee brace, which I wrap around the knee.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am hobbling around. It really has cramped my style, I can tell you, because I'm an avid gardener and I can't go out there and do as much as
right.
I would like to. And I was just wanting to know what is the final resolution of this kind of condition?
Well, for Baker cysts, usually depends on the size.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if it starts to interfere with your function, that is, the cyst gets to about, say about 4 to 5 centimeters, which is about 2 inches in size.
Right.
In length. And if it starts to interfere with your ability to flex your knee, right? So kneeling down, trying to get to do the activities you want.
Yeah.
It runs the risk of rupturing. That is, the fluid will break open and run down the inside of the leg towards the calf. Can be quite painful, but doesn't do, in terms of damage, any long-term damage. But that's sort of you really don't want it to rupture and experience all that pain.
Right.
So sometimes what is done is, if there is restriction, if the conservative treatment, that is the anti-inflammatories, bracing, if all of that doesn't help you resume your normal activities or have function of your knee the way you would like it to function, sometimes what is done is what's known as an aspiration. You put a small needle into the cyst and you try and take the fluid out.
Okay.
Rarely do you do surgery, that is major surgery, to open up the back of the knee to take that cyst out. And again, the reasoning being that you have a cyst that, if it does rupture, gives you lots of pain, but then function of the knee still remains the same.
Mm-hmm.
If you do surgery to try and remove that cyst, you have a lot of nerves and arteries
in that area
that can potentially get damaged from trying to remove it, because sometimes the cyst wall adheres to a lot of the structures in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to just start yanking a cyst out and then end up damaging other tissues or nerves that run down the leg. So ideally, if you're able to function and use these conservative measures, that's great. If, on the other hand, you're finding that, after giving this a go and it's just not working, then what you're looking at is an aspiration. Aspiration is very straightforward. It's done very carefully. The back of the knee is, you make sure that you've used aseptic technique, meaning that you've used your alcohol swabs or betadine or whatever it is that you're using to clean the skin, and the needle is inserted into that area of the knee, and usually you would freeze the skin as well, because sometimes you have to use what's known as a large bore needle.
I see.
Large bore needles simply means that the diameter of the needle itself is wider, so that you can have some ability to draw fluid through it.
Right.
And so when you're using a larger needle to poke through the skin, that can hurt quite a bit. So you use a little bit of local anesthetic
on
the surface.
You need a local anesthetic. Yeah,
to freeze the skin, and then you would put that in to try and aspirate the fluid out.
And that can be done in...
Yeah, that's a very straightforward way to do it. But you have to... you have to be aware that when you do the procedure, anytime you're putting a needle through the skin, you have to be sure that you're not going to hit any other structure. So you have to isolate that cyst very well, find the top part of it, find where it's sort of bouncy, where you can feel where the fluid collects, and you gently and slowly insert the needle until you literally draw fluid back through it. So you know
right.
that you haven't gone too far and you've gone just the right distance.
And that could be done at what, a sports clinic or a...
It can be done at sports clinics. Some family doctors will do it.
Okay.
It's a very straightforward procedure, but it's really done and it's considered a surgical procedure, even though, it's a needle going in. You're not really opening up the skin per se, but
mm-hmm.
anytime you're putting something into someone's body or taking something out, it's still considered a surgical procedure. It is done if the other measures that you've tried haven't really given you relief, or that it does not allow you to perform and use the leg the way you'd like to on a day-to-day basis.
Well, can the cyst problem kind of resolve itself?
That is a good question. Sometimes cysts will get reabsorbed.
Okay.
So it's if it's getting too large and it's interfering with your knee function, it runs the risk of rupturing. It also runs the risk of reducing your mobility of your leg, which means your muscles don't get stretched as much, which means you may end up with some atrophy or muscle weakness if you're not able to use the leg very well.
Right.
So all these factors have to be considered. But if it's a small cyst, usually they will wait on that to see if it gets reabsorbed, or if it is getting larger, then to do something to reduce it. But again, taking fluid out of a cyst when the cyst is still there still can mean that fluid can reaccumulate in there over time as well. So it's not a perfect solution.
So what can come back?
Basically, the water comes back into it. And that's pretty much it, Christine.
That's it.
All right.
Well, I just have to wait and see. And
all right.
See if I have to move to stage two. Then.
All righty.
Right.
Take care.
Okay. Thanks
all right.
a lot.
You're welcome. Right. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And we'll take a small break and come back with your questions. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And we're going to get back to the phone lines and speak to Peter. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I had a question. I'm a 39-year-old Caucasian male. When I was 18, I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, I'd been on some medication. They'd started me with Azacol, a little switched prednisone and Azacol.
Mm-hmm.
I was anemic, so doing the iron pills and stuff like that, too. I had smoked in my early teens and quit through university. And then I was reading in the early to mid-90s that people who had ulcerative colitis that smoked had fewer attacks per year.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a cigarette, and I haven't had an attack in 8 years. I smoke about 6 to 9 cigarettes per day, and I know you would never advocate this, but a lot of the doctors I've heard of prescribing the patch to their patients as well. Obviously, ulcerative colitis, I have mild psoriasis as well. It's an autoimmune disorder, but is there anything new in the last 2 decades that's coming around for autoimmune disorders or ulcerative colitis?
Well,
that's new, because every time I'm going back, I'm in my second decade or ending my second decade, so my colonoscopies are once every 2 years.
Right. Well, first to comment on the cigarettes, frankly, you're right, Peter, in that I also have patients with ulcerative colitis, and one of my patients who used to smoke and she stopped smoking found that she was having increasing difficulty. And I, in fact, said, you know, and since she went back to smoking a bit, found it helped her, she stopped smoking and it came back. I'm going, well, you know, there's possible causality here, cause and effect, considering everything else was kept the same, her treatments were the same. Medications were not changed. And so I said, you know what? Just go on a nicotine patch and start taking that. And lo and behold, with a nicotine patch, she's much more comfortable. So
right.
your comments are absolutely, I've seen it as well. So what I would suggest to you, Peter, is instead of the cigarettes, use a nicotine patch, since it seems to be the nicotine that is having the effect on the gut and not other compounds in the cigarettes. And that
Correct.
Will remove a lot of the other, because nicotine itself is not going to hurt you. It's the other stuff that's in the cigarettes, for the most
Absolutely.
Part, is going to cause the problem.
My question was with the patch, Dr. Dworkin. There's different steps to patches. There's a 3, a 2, a 1. Do you know what I mean? And I didn't know.
She's on the lowest one, the 7 milligrams throughout the day, because it's really just, and you can gauge that as well, because frankly, you're likely going to be on this forever.
Correct.
And so, it's finding the one that doesn't make it difficult for you to sleep at night, because some of these patches, you know, you can have problems sleeping, give you a bit
Correct.
More agitation.
Right.
But hey, if you've noticed that the nicotine helps you. And
well, I mean, 8 years. And,
yeah.
and you know people, I mean, there's your listeners that are suffering with ulcerative colitis. It's pretty debilitating with
Absolutely.
Regard to a living a normal life.
Yep.
And if I can find some solace in not having to pop, you know, 10 pills a day like I was in my early 20s and have a normal kind of life and pop maybe 5 or 6 cigarettes a day, although society frowns on it, and I know the medical community will as well, I'm sacrificing my heart and lungs to kind of have a regular sort of lifestyle. I just didn't know if in the past couple of decades, if anything new is coming around, if there's anything new on the horizon with ulcerative colitis. It's autoimmune. I know there's, you know, if there's anything, any kind of therapy, gene therapy.
Well, with regards to other therapies, the other therapies that are out are what's called the biologic medications, or DMARDs, D-M-A-R-D-S. So those are disease-modifying agents of rheumatic diseases, was the original designation. And these are antibody treatments, where the compound seeks out the antibodies that attack the gut and stop them from attacking the gut. So sort of blocking the destruction of the intestine by interfering with the body's immune response against it. And so those are available and they are used, but they do have side effects. They have to be monitored very carefully. One of them is called infliximab, is the generic term. They have these really weird names to them.
Right.
Cyclosporin is another one. And these are used for refractory ulcerative colitis. That is ulcerative colitis that really is not responding very well to other medications. So, okay. But there are definitely other medications available that you haven't, from my understanding, you haven't used these yet. And if the colonoscopies that you're having done every couple of years are showing stable disease, that is, it's not
progressive. No dysplasia, a little
Perfect.
Bit of swelling, but
yeah.
I mean, I'm as regular as anyone normal
so,
would be.
So you wouldn't be using these medications in that situation because the gut is reasonably calm. But
right.
What I would suggest is to switch to the nicotine patch. So that way you help your gut, you don't hurt your heart, you don't hurt your lungs, but
right.
you get the same benefit. And then that certainly would serve you much better. And there are gastroenterologists that I do know that do mention this to their patients as well. I mean, you can't negate the evidence when someone comes in and they smoke, pain goes away, they stop smoking, pain comes back, nothing else has changed, and they do this repeatedly and it happens. It may not be for everybody, but in
No.
your situation and in my patient's situation, it has helped them. And it's not doing, and in terms of harm, benefits versus risk, the benefits in this case by using the nicotine patch far outweigh the risk of smoking in order to alleviate that pain. So,
right.
So to me, it's really, I think that's great. I think you discovered that on your own, but at the same time, there certainly are others have experienced the same thing.
Well, wonderful. Thank you very much, Dr. Dworkin. I appreciate your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, and we're going to line 3 and say good afternoon to Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I have a question. For the last 2 years, I've had recurring bladder frequency.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on antibiotics, and I haven't seemed to have any. The last I had, I'm sorry, I'm very nervous.
No, don't be nervous. That's okay.
I had 3 courses of antibiotics,
mm-hmm.
and I'm allergic to penicillin, so I have to be very careful
right.
what I take. The big question that I had, I saw a urologist on Friday, but the only suggestion that he had was to take a pill to lessen the frequency.
Mm-hmm.
But the question that I had when I was talking to my daughter was something that she brought up. 2 years ago, I had E. coli and salmonella poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that there is a syndrome called E. coli syndrome. And the symptoms are exactly the same as I've been having.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any test that I can have to take to check for this?
Well, usually if there is bacterial growth, which is E. coli being a constituent of our intestines, if there is E. coli present in the urine, that will show up when they send the urine off for a culture. It'll show
yes.
the bacterial growth. It'll also show what antibiotic it may be susceptible to.
Yes.
That being said, there are situations where when you treat bladder infections, some of the bacteria have literally hooks where they hook into the wall of the bladder and are very difficult to destroy. Some may have resistance to the antibiotic, and so they can sometimes cause a bit of a problem. However, what also should be done if it hasn't been done already, and I guess I'll ask you the questions in terms of how, you know, what's on my mind, is have you had ultrasounds done? Have they looked at the bladder and the kidneys and the?
No,
okay.
I had the kidney blood test, and they said
right.
there was nothing there. But the last culture that mm-hmm. I had said there was no bacteria, but there was red and white blood cells in the urine.
Okay. So what really should happen? Because if you're, obviously this is not a solution that's satisfactory to you because you're still experiencing discomfort. What needs to be determined now is not only just assuming that an infection is involved, but rather whether there are changes to the anatomy of the urinary system that are either contributing to recurrent infections or are contributing to bladder spasm in itself that can make you feel uncomfortable. Whether there is, for example, something called interstitial cystitis, which can make you feel like you have to go to the bathroom all the time. So there are ways to analyze this. The first is an ultrasound of the, usually it's the abdomen and pelvis to look at the kidneys, the ureters that are running down from the kidneys, attaching to the bladder, making sure they follow a normal course as they enter the bladder. Sometimes they can enter from underneath into the bladder, which can then make you more susceptible to infections because the urine will pool in the little J shape as it goes in. If you think of this, your bathroom sink and the pipe that runs down and it has this little J shape curve before it continues down. In that J shape is where water can accumulate. Well, in the same thing as the ureters run to the bladder, if they don't run into the top of the bladder or for some reason it has shifted a bit and the ureters have now run underneath, urine can pool there and that can cause infection. Other things that are done are analyses of the bladder itself. So they will use what's called a cystoscope and look into the bladder, sometimes take a biopsy of the bladder wall to see if there is anything that's causing damage to the bladder wall, looking at the bladder wall itself to see if there's any erosions, any source for the bleeding, any inflammation, and also trying to make a determination of whether there is as one of the differential diagnoses or possibilities of interstitial cystitis. So there's mm-hmm. a whole range of things that need to be done, Mary, that haven't been done yet. And so I would actually either go back to your family doctor first because they can order the ultrasound, but also to ask the urologist at the same time, you know, what about other possibilities? Is it interstitial cystitis? Is it the bladder wall being irritated for some reason? Can we now do something to figure that out? Other things that they will do is that when they do a cystoscopy, they will also put water into the bladder to see how well the bladder responds to being filled. And if they find that the bladder is really hyperreactive with a little bit of fluid in it, that also helps make a diagnosis that you have a hyperactive bladder, and there are things that can help calm that down. So the focus up to now has been antibiotics, but it seems that there's a lot of other aspects to this that need to be evaluated in order to find out what's causing this. Because if you don't have any bacterial growth, the cultures have been negative, you're still having the problem, there's still something causing that problem.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we have to take a break now, Mary, but I hope that was helpful for you.
Yes, thank you. I can go and start making demanding now.
Okay.
Thank you. All
the best to you.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. And we are going to take a small break and be back in a couple of minutes. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your questions very soon.
580 CFRA Sunday House Call. Your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. On 8255.
And we do have lines available at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. And we're going to line 4, and good afternoon to Sherry.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I have schizoaffective disorder,
mm-hmm.
and I've been prescribed 400 milligrams of Seroquel at nighttime.
Okay.
Okay, and every 2 weeks I get an injection of Consta Risperidol,
mm-hmm.
37.5 milligrams, and it's made me gain about 60 pounds.
Yes.
And I'm missing my menstrual.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had it in over, it'll be year last April, and they say it's a medication. So my two questions to you is, mm-hmm. how do I lose the weight?
Mm-hmm.
And what medications is stopping my menstrual?
Well, actually, what may be happening, Sherry, is that you're indeed correct. The Seroquel is a medication that certainly can cause weight gain. In fact, There is evidence that it causes sometimes about, I'm looking for the exact amount here. They had a weight gain of about 5 kilograms, an average of 5 kilograms a year, but that's about 11 pounds, but you can gain a lot more. And one of the problems with weight gain is that, especially if it's excessive weight gain, there's increased risk of type 2 diabetes as a result of the weight gain. So my questions first off are these medications helping you with regards to the schizoaffective disorder?
Yes, they are.
Okay. So now the second question that comes from this is that there are likely other medications that can be used to treat this. They may or may not help you lose weight, because they usually, antipsychotic medications have that as a side effect, is that they can cause weight gain. So it becomes an issue of controlling the disease, quality of life, and also trying to control the weight. So in terms of the weight loss, these medications tend to stimulate appetite. I would imagine you tend to eat more because of them.
I don't have an appetite, to be honest with you.
Right, but the 60 pounds has to come from food, because...
Yes, so, but I don't eat junk food.
No, but it's probably the quantity is probably a bit more.
Okay.
In order to gain 60 pounds, that implies that you have to be taking in more, and the medications can either increase appetite, or just it takes longer to feel full while you're eating. And so you tend to eat more until your body says, I've had enough. But the switch that tells you that you've had enough only switches on after you eat a lot more food than you normally used to. So this really means that, now, I guess, have you spoken to your psychiatrists about your concerns about the weight gain and whether there are other solutions available?
Yes, she dropped me down by 100 milligrams mm-hmm. on the Seroquel.
Right.
Okay, and I have sleep apnea,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't sleeping with the 300 milligrams, so she gave me 400 milligrams
right.
again.
Now, did the sleep apnea develop after you gained the weight?
Yes.
Yeah. This is the proverbial rock in a hard place, Sherry, where you have a disease that an illness, a schizoaffective disorder that can cause tremendous harm from both social and emotional standpoints. And at the same time, that being controlled is now contributing, the treatment is contributing to other diseases that also interfere with your quality of life, especially the sleep apnea. Sleep apnea can cause weight gain in and of itself because it can disrupt your normal appetite center. It also can cause worsening of weight gain itself, is associated with type 2 diabetes. So it sort of goes around in a vicious circle that you treat one thing, but something else pops up.
Right.
What I would ask your psychiatrist is essentially to say, look, you know, thank you for treating the schizoaffective disorder. It's stable, but now I have sleep apnea. Now I have this weight gain. I have the potential to develop type 2 diabetes. That introduces a whole bunch of other medical problems, primarily related to the way the schizoaffective disorder is being treated. That's not to say it's the wrong... I mean, it helped your schizoaffective disorder. So it's not to say that your psychiatrist purposefully did something to cause these other side effects to happen. But nevertheless, these side effects are going to cause, from what you're describing, they are causing some hardship.
Yes.
So the question I would ask the psychiatrist, because this is an area for which, I will follow treatments recommended by psychiatrists after my patients have seen them, especially for schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorders. But I'm certainly no expert when it comes to determining what medications to use to treat it. And so I can't really give you a list of medications that are available. That is certainly within the domain of the psychiatrists themselves.
Okay.
But I really, you know, given from what you described, I mean, you've had weight gain, you're likely to continue gaining weight with the treatment, which is, again, that is a problem that you're rightly noting and really needs to be addressed. You can't ignore that aspect of it. It's great that the schizoaffective disorder is well controlled, but it's still the other stuff that's happening that needs to be addressed as well. And so you have to draw upon their expertise and say, okay, let's find a different solution that doesn't give me back my schizoaffective disorder, but at the same time helps me start to reduce my weight and reverse the process. I'd like to get rid of my sleep apnea. I'd like to reduce my risk of diabetes. And is there a way, is there evidence that shows other treatments that are available will help me achieve that? And that's the question you have to ask them in order to know what direction to go.
Yes. And having no menstrual, what is the cause of that?
Usually when you have weight gain, especially if you've gained a lot of weight, the extra fat tissue from that weight gain will produce estrogen and sometimes produce more than your body needs, or at least produces enough to actually interfere with your menstrual cycle.
Sorry?
What happens is that the estrogen that is produced by the weight gain, because fat tissue will produce estrogen, so that the extra estrogen will interfere with your cycle and cause the problem that you're seeing.
Okay, I see.
So that's where, again, weight loss usually will result in a resumption of your cycle, your normal cycle. But because fat tissue itself has an enzyme that helps produce estrogen, that in itself can cause problems with your menstrual cycle.
Okay, because I looked it up. I looked up const on the internet, and I looked up Seroquel, and it doesn't say diminished menstrual at all.
No, but the weight gain itself does. The Seroquel won't do that, but the result of the weight gain because of taking the Seroquel can do that.
Okay, I understand.
So it's a secondary effect of the weight gain.
Okay.
So I wish you the best, Sherry. I hope they find a solution for you. But what you are reporting is actually quite common and is experienced by a lot of people, unfortunately, with the medications that are used to treat schizophrenia and other psychoses.
Yeah, so Consta has nothing to do with it.
I'm not overly familiar with that particular medication. Usually antipsychotics do have an effect on weight gain. So I would speak to your psychiatrist and ask them if that indeed is a side effect of that particular medication as well. But I don't have much experience with that particular one, so
okay.
I don't want to provide you with any inaccurate information. That really should come from the psychiatrist.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Sherry.
Okay.
All the best to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And that raises a very good point, and I would point you to an article written by Dr. Ben Goldacre in The Guardian yesterday. The Guardian in the UK, and it's called Give Us the Trial Data. And this has to do with AstraZeneca paying out £125 million to settle a class action lawsuit with 17,500 patients who were taking the drug quetiapine, which is Seroquel, because it might cause diabetes and weight gain. And this article talks about how they knowingly held back data that showed this. And in fact, the quote came from John Tumas, publications manager at AstraZeneca, who said in an email, "Please allow me to join the fray," in response to a colleague. "There has been a precedent set regarding cherry picking of data. Cherry picking is where you report only flattering data and ignore or bury data you don't like." The company itself said that it did, in fact, what John Tumas says is that they did bury some data that indicated that in order to make the drug look a little bit better. So class action lawsuit, AstraZeneca has paid out money to deal with this, but you can find this on Ben Goldacre's website, badscience.net. It's the first article at the top of the page, and also from the Guardian newspaper to review that particular practice. My thanks to Phil Godreau for producing Sunday House Call. And I invite you to stay tuned to hear a new show on CFRA. It is called The Motts. They're a husband and wife team, and we'll hope you'll enjoy them. It's coming up next on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA. And I'd like to thank all of you for listening and your calls and questions. We'll be back next week with another edition. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.